Hello, everyone, and welcome to Filmstrips, which would just like to point out that, no, the Super Mario Brothers movie is not the worst thing Bob Hoskins has ever done, not by a long shot. I'm Dave Babbitt.
And I'm Andrew Canageezer, Paisanos, and, Dave, here on Filmstrips, we often use the driving or travel metaphor as a loose framework. I would just like to ask you, do you ever notice that white guys drive like this? Actually have a passenger in our merry little vehicle this episode. Who do we have with us?
Hey, everybody, it's me, James Rivnak.
Hello!
Thanks for having me back, guys, especially for this.
Oh, yes, it's Misery Does Love Company.
Which, I will say, I did volunteer for.
Well, you know, the few, the proud, many are called, and so on and so forth. Before we get too inside on this baseball game, though, Dave, why don't you tell the good people at home, who are we, what are we doing with everyone's time this episode?
Why, this is Filmstrips, the podcast in which each and every week we take a look at a film, throw it under the microscope, look at the nuance, the subtext, the paratext, spoil the ever-loving hell out of it. The important thing is that each and every film under discussion must somehow connect back to the film we discussed upon the preceding episode. And Andrew, what were we taking a look at last time in this little program of ours?
Last time, we were looking at a film that has aged well, like a nice Cabernet Sauvignon, in the form of Spike Lee's L'Homme Inside, The Inside Man. Which, yeah.
That's a great movie.
Yeah, it was just as much fun this time around as it was the last time we watched it. Had a lot of good things to say, and a lot of it came down to the fact that a great cast can do 90% of the film's heavy lifting for you. From that, we decided to follow you know, someone whose performance we really enjoyed, one Denzel Washington. We decided to follow him back to a film I had never heard of until Dave told us we were going there. And odds are, a film that none of you at home have heard of. We are going back to 1990, a simpler time, when writer and director James D. Parriott decided to put together a little movie called Heart Condition, featuring a performance by Denzel Washington opposite Bob Hoskins, with a cast rounded out by Chloe Webb, Roger Mosley, Janet Dubois, Alan Ratchins,
Rakins,
I think,
and Jeffrey Meek. Yeah, well, I mean, early 90s cinema, Denzel Washington and Bob Hoskins and Chloe Webb, well, this movie certainly has three strikes in its favor. I wonder why no one remembers this.
Well, it could be because the third live-action Raiden is the villain of this movie, but no, there are far worse versions of that, or far worse problems that we're going to need to address tonight.
Spoiler alert. You think? This is going to be a fun episode because we have an absolute train wreck of a movie.
Yeah. You were jumping in there, James?
I was just going to say, yes, there's a lot going on here.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, I mean, I guess maybe as a jumping off point, I mean, we've seen and we've talked about a number of films that sort of use kind of the buddy cop framework. We've talked about films that like 48 Hours or the Richard Pryor, Gene Wilder films, where the idea of different kinds of people who are also racially different from each other could be a font for, you know, a greater learning. It could be a teaching moment. In the case of Green Book, it can get you Best Picture. Also in the case of Crash. But that's not to say that it always works out the way that you want it to. And I think especially in 2021, three well-meaning white, somewhat intellectuals, going back to forgotten tones of the early 1990s, it's kind of interesting how well good intentions curdle over time, like the proverbial milk.
Oh, that's putting it mildly.
Yeah.
That implies that there was a point when this hadn't already been curdled to begin with.
Yeah, that's fair.
Fair enough.
Very fair.
But I think it would behoove us, though, to get everyone on the same page. And Andrew, how does one get on the same page on this show?
Oh, James, you've been on this show enough. Don't you know? You throw it to Dave, who's going to do what he does best and give us the rundown.
Heart Condition is the 1990 comedy starring Denzel Washington and Bob Hoskins. Written and directed by James D. Perriott, the film follows a racist cop who receives a heart transplant from a black defense attorney he hated. Following his recovery, the spirit of the dead lawyer challenges the officer to find his killers. A critical and commercial disaster upon release, the film has mostly been overshadowed by the bigger successes and higher profile bombs in the careers of both Hoskins and Washington. Coming up after film strips, an episode of the short-lived reboot of Manimal, starring Rip Taylor.
I don't really know where to start with this movie. I mean, like, there's not a whole lot of, Dave, as you noted in the notes, there's not a whole lot of, like, production anecdotes or notes available on this movie. I guess we should start, I don't know, with just the plot or just general setting up with where this movie fit in the landscape of 1990. Because 1990 is a pretty interesting year, more so than, like, I guess, like, the turn of other decades between, like, 79 and 80, or 2009 to 2010 kind of thing. I got 99 to 2000 is pretty interesting, but that's a whole other discussion. So, like, because it felt like, and I don't know if you gentlemen remember this, I was 9 going on 10 that year, and...
Wait, you're 5 years older than me? I realize I learned this, like, every 2 years all over again, and I'm still surprised every time.
It felt like there was, like, a distinctive, and at least in terms of pop culture and specifically marketing, I don't know, like, this idea that the 90s were new and fresh, as if somehow arbitrarily changing, you know, from 89 to 90 would bring about, like, some sort of cultural revolution, that we were suddenly, you know, this much closer to the future, and there was this weird air about something new. But that's of course, like, a fallacy, because there was so much, like, for the first couple of years at least anyway, before we sort of, like, got into this cultural idea of, like, what the 90s are, what's going on, especially, you know, with stuff that happens in, let's say, LA in the early 90s. That sort of, like, bring on, like, a sea change. But there was this hangover where no one really knew what to do, or, like, had, like, a clear idea of, like, what kind of stories we wanted to tell, or how to bridge that gap between what was becoming stale and old and finding what was new and, you know, I guess, hip.
I have an idea for a story, one that can capture the zeitgeist of what the 90s would become. Let's get a racist cop to be haunted by a deceased black lawyer, and we'll have about 7 different plots being juggled in the air all at the same time. I mean, I see what you're saying, James, and sort of, like, this idea of, certainly in the 90s, like, they're... And I guess this is the same with every new decade, in a sense, where it's, you know, you're almost looking forward to what could this decade be.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also, I think you almost look so far into the future, it ends up being a kind of idealism that is completely out of step with conditions in the present. I mean, what we end up having in this case is a film that I think does mean well, but as with a lot of other films in this vein, its well-meaningness ultimately reduces very complicated questions of social division, and indeed sort of, like, audience expectations, and just reduces it down to, well, if you can help somebody out transactionally, that solves racism.
Well, yeah, and to speak to your point, James, I think... I think part of why we can sort of say that there's that shift, or that feeling at least of a shifting in the 90s, is certainly comes down to, I think in large part, probably the fall of the Berlin Wall, because mm-hmm. the Cold War had been hanging over everybody for so long. To even have that opening up there, that massive shift in there, I mean, that had to have had a psychological impact on everybody across the board by that point in time.
Yeah.
I was just thinking, so Heart Condition is Gorbachev's fault if he held on a little bit longer?
I'm not going to go that far. Point being here.
But you're very right, David, because like the Berlin Wall symbolically and the Cold War itself was more or less the dominant geopolitical framework that everybody lived under following the end of the Second World War. And sort of with that brings a sort of global division and also just a very specific way of thinking about social order at sort of the planetary level, and all of a sudden that is undone.
And now the healing can begin.
Exactly.
Quote unquote. And but I will say this, that to speak to the other side of your point, James, about how this is a fallacy, certainly, is also looking that when we come to this film in particular, what we're seeing is sort of a combination of trends coming together. Because as you noted before the break there, Andrew, we certainly have, even though this is not a buddy cop film, that buddy cop genre certainly influences this film. Likewise, it's hard not to look over the preceding decade of sort of supernatural comedies is really coming to a head here. Because
I'm thinking Ghost Dad.
Which came out the same year. It came out actually after this movie.
Yeah, oh, wow. And then there was... And if I'm not mistaken, Ghost, the Patrick Swayze Demi Moore film, was either this year or was it the year prior?
I think it's 92, isn't it?
Oh, that's that much later? Okay, maybe I'm wrong.
Let me confirm.
Yeah, but certainly even putting that aside, there was Beetlejuice, there was Ghostbusters.
1990, same year.
It is the same year. So yeah, so 1990
is... Yeah, look at that.
Just like you have these trends sort of going there, and then you have...
What was in the water?
Well, good question, and I think... Again, a lot of stuff. I mean, let's also not forget, I think 1990 is also the year Ghosts Don't Do It, the Bo Derek movie with Anthony Quinn, where, yeah, that's a film. It exists.
Nice.
I think that's 1990 as well. But the key thing here is to come to this film in particular, I think probably part of what will help us understand is not just that those two sort of trends are coming to a head in this film, but it's also worth, I think, considering our two leading men and the careers that they had been leading up to as well by this point, because these are both, I mean, Bob Hoskins and Denzel Washington isn't necessarily the pairing that would automatically come to mind, I think, in many ways here, because certainly in the case of Bob Hoskins, who we've covered quite extensively prior, you know, British character actor who became huge in the UK and finally broke through in 88 with Who Framed Roger Rabbit, being his sort of big American breakthrough that puts him on the map here, over there. And then you've got Denzel Washington, who is somebody who, over the course of the preceding decade, had been steadily building his career through television and film, sort of defining himself in a way. And this is sort of Denzel before, like, I think we can safely say the 90s is where Denzel finally arrives, because he's got Mo Better Blues coming out this year. Within 2 years, he's doing Malcolm X there, and then he goes on
to... Well, let's also not overlook, though, through the 80s, like, his notable film roles all... How do I put this? They're all films that also, I guess, for better and for worse, are also films that want to make a statement about race. And I'm thinking in particular Richard Attenborough's Cry Freedom and his performance in Glory, which, granted, he won Best Supporting Actor this film comes out.
This was his follow-up.
Yeah, so, I mean, I think most of us revisiting Glory can sort of see the clear problems. Is that an Edward Zwick movie?
Yep.
Yeah, you bet it is.
Yeah, and it definitely feels like an Edward Zwick movie.
It's part of his White People Where They Don't Belong series.
But also teaching everybody their own blind spots. Truly building a big monochromatic rainbow where everything is gray and flat and lifeless. I guess with those threads together, the other consideration is that we've talked about genre cycles many times, and the idea that within any genre, you can only sort of have the same basic framework so many times before you need to innovate a little bit. So through the 80s, we see sort of like white guy, black guy, buddy comedies. We see paranormal comedies. We see cop movies. Let's throw them all together in a blender, and we'll have an interracial buddy comedy from beyond the grave.
Yeah, and the thing is the basically this brings us to this film's writer and director, because yes, this is an auteur project here, folks. James D. Perriott in this instance, who for the most part has worked in television. He's still working as a producer and director and writer these days. A lot of his credits are he's worked on shows such as he wrote some episodes of The Incredible Hulk back in the 80s. He worked on the show Forever Night for the few people who remember that one. And then, of course, there's the late belated...
Co-created it.
Yeah. And then, of course, there's Hawaiian Heat, which has an amazing theme song and is the only thing anybody remembers about that show in this instance.
Dave, I believe it's pronounced Hawaii 5-0. I'm also going to go out on a limb here and say I'm pretty sure James Perriott is a white man.
You're not wrong. Yes, he is. And I have absolutely no idea how he ended up in the position to get this particular film made. But the important thing is that somehow he convinces New Line Cinema to pony up the dough to make this film based upon actually trying the cast members of this film. So there were two sort of central characters, as we'll get into, that needed to be cast. For the role of Mooney, which would ultimately be played by Bob Hoskins, they went through a ton of people to try and get to play this role, including Brian Dennehy, which would have been interesting. I'm not going to lie. There.
He's too busy trying to get FX2 off the ground.
Damn. Yeah, I would buy him as an old drunk racist.
Yep.
Yeah. And then you had, but the bigger challenge was who was going to play the character of Napoleon Stone, which was ultimately played by Denzel Washington. Now, apparently a lot of this film was dependent on getting Washington because he was viewed as one of the quote unquote few bankable black stars in American cinema at that point in time. Point is that with Denzel, they try to skewer him, and this is what we'll put it this way. There are two things we'll need to point out here. Denzel Washington apparently was hesitant to do this movie from the sounds of things. Apparently, the character of Napoleon Stone in the original script was supposedly written to be a pimp.
Yeah, and not just any pimp. We're talking like Superfly, Sweet Sweetback era, you know, that kind of pimp.
Yeah, which Denzel did not want to play. I kind of understand why. And, yeah.
And the studio's like, I can't believe no black actors with name value want to take on this role. What are we doing wrong?
Yes, now apparently they took his suggestion. It's like, I'm not playing this, but if you made some changes, I would consider it and agree to it. Now, this has led to a bit of a legend, however, because the legend of this film that apparently a few years ago Denzel Washington finally shot down was that he did not want to do this movie and that his agent talked him into it. And afterwards, when the film came out and was received the way it was, he proceeded to fire that agent. Supposedly, that never happened. Having said that, if I were Denzel Washington, I'm not sure I would be denying that story, because that sounds like at least a get-out-of-jail-free card here, because... Yeah.
It's like, if it didn't happen, it should have happened.
Exactly, because I still have a hard time when we see the final result imagining that if the script looked anything like this, that this was a wise choice. But this also brings us to, I think, the other strand, which is Denzel Washington's eternal quest to star in comedies, something he seems absolutely incapable of doing. Because let's look at the grand history of success he had. Going back to the early stage of his career, to which I would say you can't blame him for this one, job's a job, there's Carbon Copy, where he's the son of George Segal. And the whole film's built around George Segal being shocked that he has a black son in that movie.
Oh my God.
That is... What next, Lady Drivers?
Yeah, it's as bad as you think it is, folks. Then he would go on to do this, which we'll get into. And then, of course, probably arguably the most successful, The Bishop's Wife, which, again, it's not so much a bad movie as it is just a nothing movie, but I swear.
Yeah, it's pretty fluffy.
Yeah.
Which is odd though, because like, especially as we saw last week, Denzel Washington has a ton of charm, and he has really good comic timing. Just not when he appears in comedies.
Well, absolutely. There's almost this Robert De Niro-esque side of him where it's like he so badly wants to be in a comedy, but just doesn't understand. Either he cannot find good projects to suit him for that, or he just has the worst taste in what those may be. And it's...
Now I'm just imagining Denzel Washington in his voice asking Greg if he can milk him. Yeah, it doesn't cut the same.
No.
But yeah, so the point is they secure Hoskins, they secure Washington, they make this film, and then it gets released. And James, how would you say this film was received at the time?
I would say it's received very poorly. Although I will say I was surprised to see Roger Ebert gave it 2 stars out of 4, which I think is being wildly generous.
Oh yeah,
Ebert's weird though, because like
he is weird.
I mean, he is so influential as a critic and as an essayist, but you go back and you're like, look, if there was a movie where there were a lot of topless scenes, Ebert's given that a 3, you know. You read enough of them and it's like, well, Ebert does think it's pretty funny when white guys and black guys try to get along. You know, it's, I wonder what he would have made of Bringing Down the House, which Larry King called one of the funniest movies ever made.
Oh boy. But,
yeah, it, if this film, intended to set the 1990s off, with a big unifying statement about, where America could go in terms of race relations, well, it unified public opinion in the sense that nobody liked this movie.
Yeah, this thing tanked, and it tanked hard at the box office, and there's kind of a reason.
I don't know what the budget was, but it only made, according to Wikipedia, which is of course never wrong, around $4 million, and it was released in February, and which is typically dumping ground for good movies.
But 1990, like $4 million is like 38 Bitcoin now.
But either way, it doesn't cover the production budget, guaranteed. Because forgetting Hoskins and Denzel alone, it's there. I mean, I can't imagine their paychecks were sub $1 million each. I would imagine both would be.
I mean, again, like Hoskins was coming right off of Who Framed Roger Rabbit, which was a gargantuan hit.
Yeah. And Washington is coming off of an Oscar win. So this $4 million may have covered like the opening credit font,
which we'll get to that font. Absolutely. James, you were jumping in there.
I was going to say theoretically he hadn't won the Oscar yet, because this would have come out in February, and the Oscars are for the previous year are held, I think, at the end of the month, or they used to be in March.
Yeah.
I don't speak so nerd.
He's okay.
Yeah. Theoretically, but like,
I love it. It's always that, like, in that, you know, surely the buzz would have been about, you know, in the press at that time.
Yeah.
But it's that great, like, you know, that up and coming star has this like incredible performance in this noteworthy film that's getting a lot of buzz and a lot of traction, and then there's that sneaky distributor out back who's just like, oh, I got something for you guys.
It's the Norbit of its time. But yeah, I mean, this thing just comes and goes. And for the most part, it's been forgotten. I think much to Denzel's desire, I'm sure that this is not the film he wants anybody to remember in a career. And the good news is it's worked out pretty good for him, which is unfortunate, because our show exists, and you know, we're going to spread the word a little bit more that yes, this piece of garbage is out there. And I mean, like, before we even get into the film here, I mean, the basic premise, the thing that would have been in the trailers, and believe me, the trailers, if you've seen it, treat this like it's a zany comedy. There,
I want to talk about that.
At times,
later.
It really wants to be.
Yeah,
but it has no idea how. This is one of like the worst examples of here's a zany premise. Lawyer dies. his heart goes into someone else so he can live, and now he gets haunted by Denzel Washington. A premise that feels like it should be funny. There are, like, no jokes in this movie.
Well, yeah, and the jokes that are there fall so flat. And
yes,
more to the point, the problem is that it's one thing if you want to be a zany comedy. It's another thing when you build it around the premise of, yeah, his heart's going into that of a racist cop who deliberately hates this man with a thriving passion. Yes. And we will get into that at the very start of this movie, just how much, well, Bob Hoskins character hates him. But I think
there's also, there's a way that you can set it up that it actually is an amusing premise. And I think the best way to set that up is with an incredibly drawn out slow motion sequence of sex workers and a politician doing cocaine and one of them overdoses.
All right.
But like, this film, it does...
I thought I was watching the wrong movie when that started.
I honestly did as well. I thought there was something wrong with the playback, because I'm like, why is it in slow motion for this long? But it's also a film that, you know, if it wants to be a comedy, it also veers hard into serious drama. Yeah. For about the final third of it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this film is tonal whiplash, but I think you're right, James, where, like, so much of the humor is just the premise of, these guys, they're not at all alike. And that sort of takes the place of actual, like, gags or writing, beyond mm-hmm. the obvious stuff of, well, Bob Hoskins can see him, but nobody else can.
Yeah.
And they don't even make that, like, they don't even do really anything with that.
Well,
other than the brilliant callback at the very end.
Yeah. Oh, we'll get there, trust me. So, yeah, to get into the...
Can we just talk about the ending first?
I think we gotta save our saving grace for later here.
Okay.
All right, because, okay, so to come back to how this film opens here. So yes, as Andrew outlined, yes, our opening scene is seeing a series of sex workers, scantily clad, but not quite nude, with a what will end up turning out to be a U.S. senator who was elected on an anti-drug campaign, indulging in drugs and ultimately dying of a heart attack. Now, one of these...
Oh, those fat cats. Is he also wearing, like, a tribal mask at some point?
I think it's supposed to be, which raises all sorts of other problems that are never addressed in this movie. We got way too much to chew off right now already. Yeah. But
it's a hell of a 2 minutes, I'll give it that.
But yeah, so the first things first. So yeah, one of the women is played by Chloe Webb, and she is playing Crystal Garrity. Keep that in mind there, because it's going to be important in a little bit, even if you don't think it is at first. But the thing is, I want to know here is, yeah, in addition to the absurd slow motion usage for no discernible reason while Garrity is firing off photos this entire time, let's speak about the font that the text or that the opening credits are in, because I see what you were trying to do, movie. You want to have this sort of neon sign design as the credits play out, and you've got the sort of jazz soundtrack going on here. The problem is, I'm watching this film in HD, and every time the neon lettering kicks in, it is so blurry that you can barely make out what each of the credits are as this is showing.
Yeah,
because
it's also like handwriting style font. Yeah, it's like, so really... I'm like, I genuinely can't even read this.
Yeah.
I think James Perriott looked into the future and was like, one day there will be a film called Drive and people are going to love it. So I'm going to get in on the ground floor.
See, I went with the opposite direction, which was, how can we hide as many of our names as possible? And yeah, this was the technique we settled on. But the point is once we finally get the credits over with and the slow motion finally mercifully ends with the senator's death, we quickly see a cleanup crew here to clean up the scene. Somebody is there being told, it's like, yes, we're going to deal with it, don't worry. And one of them offhand's like, I can't believe I voted for this guy. And then we cut to Bob Hoskins as detective, or not even detective, but Officer Jack Mooney, as he's sitting there stuffing his face full of French fries, talking with his one partner in this instance, as they're talking about the fact that, you know, we got our promotion coming up, and this is all going on while there's a sting operation happening here, where another officer is...
Well, they're also talking about basketball, you'll know.
Yes.
And it was, who is it, Kurt Rambo, who played for the Lakers, notably one of the white Lakers, and after he was just let go by the team. And Mooney keeps saying that, oh, you know, I think that was why. And you get that very, like, very early 1990s proto-white replacement theory being penciled in right there.
Yeah.
And then, yes, it turns out no time for... no time to talk eugenics. We gotta pull off a bust here.
Yeah, so the point of the matter is, yes, they go, because they're all Vice Squad members, we should note here. Mm-hmm. Yeah, sadly, this is not going to be Fear City, which somehow is the better movie in this case. But
or Vice Squad.
Or Vice Squad. But the big thing here is, yeah, they are taking off in there, and they're supposed to be following the young officer who is with this sex worker in order to make sure that they catch her. Except, as they're driving there, Mooney spots something out of the corner of his eye, which is another car, a much nicer car, driving past him. And who's in the front seat? Well, none other than defense attorney Napoleon Stone, who, as we will see, Jack Mooney hates for some reason. So much so that for no discernible reason, he does a U-turn illegally in the street to start chasing after Stone, leaving his partner, who's desperately planning. It's like, we're up for promotion. What are you doing? You have nothing against this guy. Leave him be. And Stone is just furious, talking about how he's a pimp and other things at this point in time. Which,
well, he also has the great line that gets called back, which is, if you want to throw strikes, you gotta use your balls.
Yeah.
Like, it's like, maybe in the context of, like, the most extrajudicial arrest imaginable, maybe doesn't fly. It's also like, this really feels like it belongs out of, like, it feels like a live-action cartoon. Because with the slightest provocation, Mooney pulls his gun, opens fire, and then they get into a car chase, and then it's like this cat-and-mouse sequence. It really does not suit how serious the film ultimately ends up becoming.
Well, and this is the frustrating thing, because you're right, it's super cartoonish, and yet what this goes on to be is they follow Stone out of their jurisdiction into Beverly Hills to a fine dining restaurant where Stone is picking up Garrity and her partner in this instance. We don't hear what they're saying, but we know that at one point Stone just sort of slaps her hand away as she's because he's clearly upset about something. And Mooney uses
the... No, he gives her the Hank Pym special. I think he gets her right in the face.
Really? Do you remember, James? Like, I could have sworn it wasn't that. But
no, I don't remember.
Yeah. The point is that Mooney uses this. It's like, nope, we're going in. He pulls out his gun. He starts shooting. And it turns out part of what we learn at this point is that Garrity was Mooney's ex-girlfriend. They were living together in an apartment. She left him for reasons that are not clearly spelled out yet. Although, as we will see throughout the rest of the sequence, we have...
You can probably guess.
Yeah. Basically...
Because he wouldn't stop talking about Kurt Rambis.
Well, in this instance, yeah, he starts chasing Stone for no provocation, shooting at him in this instance, which is a clear use of excessive force, to put it mildly. We get this whole cat and mouse chase where, yes, it turns out Stone has taken the cocaine that was on Garrity in this instance, and he's basically looking for a place to dump it. And again, Hoskins is just chasing him. And like, again, they're playing this like it's a big zany chase sequence that you would find in a comedy. But the actual context of the situation, it's not like Stone has some just deeply personal grudge against somebody for weird reasons. Like, oh, you stole money from me, or oh, you know, you did something that just made me angry. It is clearly racial prejudice. Which, I don't care what you are, movie, you cannot treat that as a zany thing to motivate your sequence here. And...
Well, and just to make sure that we know it's motivated by racial animus, how does this zany sequence come to a close?
Oh, God. Eventually, Stone walks into a couple officers who happen to be by, and basically he starts pointing out to him, it's like, look, this man, he has been chasing me, he's harassing me, can you please do something about him? And yeah, Mooney, who's huffing and puffing and clearly not remotely in shape, he listens to this. The officers are...
You think he has a heart condition?
He may have a heart condition. But the officers, who are clearly about to side with Stone in this instance, Mooney just decides to punch Stone in the stomach. Bad choice, number one, and hardly going to work in your favor in front of a bunch of witnesses. But then decides to drop the N-word. The first of numerous times this is going to happen in this movie, folks. So... Yeah, if we're supposed to be on the side of Jack Mooney, or at least find him a likable curmudgeon, you've gotten off to a terrible start here, film. An absolutely godforsakenly terrible start.
Well, it's the difference between, you know, sort of the lovable crank or someone who has the seeds of goodness within themselves versus being like, hey, this movie's going to be a barrel of laughs. Meet your protagonist. He's absolutely loathsome.
Well, and... like I said, and I will say this, here is what I will say to this film's credit. The only reason you do not completely hate Jack Mooney is that somehow Bob Hoskins at least finds the smidgen of humanity to bring out in this. And that's only because he is so damn good as an actor and basically plays the idea of wounded rawness so well later in the film that you can at least sit there and say, well... I don't know how, but I'm at least willing to see this through to the end. It's not a redemption for these choices, folks. Don't get me wrong here. This is still awful in every way, but that's the only thing that makes this remotely palatable in this instance. Having said that...
I think what they're going for is trying to, like, with this scene, maybe, and it's so hard because it's such a bad movie... that, like, it's really hard to see intentions, right? Like, is it just, you know... Perriott trying to set up Bob Hoskins so he can grow, quote unquote, grow by the end of it, which, you know, he supposedly does.
That's kind spoiler of alert.
What? Right? Like, it's just stacking the cards, like, oh, he's like, he's all of these things.
Well,
but then you run into the American History X problem, where it says the only thing that it takes to get an avowed neo-Nazi to change his ways is to make him laugh when you're on laundry duty a couple times. You know, it's... like, also, it's just the film never really articulates any of Mooney's animus beyond, that's just the way I am. I'm old school. And it's like... I don't know if this film truly understands how it sees its subject.
Well,
because the other problem is, like, for all we present Mooney as, like, a pretty wretched person, and the film, I think, is pretty clear that, like, he's in the wrong, he's a relic, right? Because mm-hmm. The follow-up scene is him talking to the captain, who, let's point out, is also a black man, and, you know, basically gives him the dressing down while laughing his head off, which is one of the few amusing scenes mm-hmm. in the movie. Captain Went here, played by Roger Mosley, who just can't stop laughing because, as he points out, so you open fire, you got into an unauthorized chase, and then in front of about 100 other people, you punched the suspect and you called him the N-word. And then you ask about your promotion status? And then he has the line where it's like, let's make one thing clear. There are words that I can say and you cannot. And then he proceeds to just matter-of-factly cork off a whole lot of N-words.
Yep.
You know, and it does feel very 90s cutting edge. But I mean, I do like the way that Mosley plays it, where he absolutely has no respect for Mooney. And I think that's kind of what the film needs at this juncture.
That is like the one scene where, and it's fortunate that it was at the beginning because it gave me that little glimmer of hope.
Yeah.
Because I was like, okay, maybe I'm not going to be in for a good movie, but at least I'll be in for an interesting one, and it didn't even, you know, fulfill that.
Well,
yeah. Spoilers. But yeah, then, so Mooney ends up turning in his badge and gun. He's taken off duty, and then What next? He just starts drinking a lot with his cat.
Yeah.
While talking out loud about his problems, and then he suffers a heart attack.
Well, there's two key details before we get to that. Because number one, as he's leaving after being suspended and has to turn his badge, he spots Stone and he spots Crystal Garrity there as well. And she talks to Moody and basically explains to him, it's like, you gotta let it go, you gotta move on. Here's a roll film, just put it in the fishbowl there. And that's gonna be important later. But yeah, sure enough, we see him wander home at this point, yeah, with the bottle booze. And yes, the cliche of, yeah, I give my cat stuff to liquor to drink there. Because, yeah, I'm sure that's what people actually do. Has anybody actually done that? But
no.
Yeah. And but yes,
I gave a cat lasagna. It didn't turn out so well.
Understandable. But yeah, the big thing here is that certainly in this instance, Mooney yet has a massive heart attack, and the only thing he's able to do is to quickly call 911 before he passes out. And we see him getting pulled into the hospital, where it's explained to his good friends at the office, from the office, it's like, look, he has had a massive heart attack. He is going to die unless he actually we luck out in getting a heart from him. But which the it turns out there is a good news here for Mooney in this instance is that, yes, somebody just died in a car crash, an accident. And
great news.
Yeah. So
huzzah!
In this instance, this leads to, as we'll see, it turns out who is the person who's died in a car accident who happens to have the right blood type to match Mooney and his heart's transferable? Why, none other than Napoleon Stone. And okay, let's pause for a moment, because this leads to the shot when they reveal this of Denzel being dragged in on the cart, and it comes into a close-up, and then the music cue that they use is got to be like the most stereotypical trying to bring in sort of a world beat moment there and playing it like it's a music stinger punchline. It is just so wrong here. And
well, you also get that very, very 1990s dialogue between the two surgeons where it's like, so who is this stiff? Oh, he better not be a lawyer. And it's like, oh,
yeah,
you know, it feels very much like Supper Club in the Catskills type material.
Yeah.
But it turns out it is a lawyer. And what's more, a lawyer of color. Who would have seen this coming?
Well, what you're not going to see coming is from about a week or two later when Mooney starts waking up after the surgery and is finally conscious, because it turns out in one of the worst scenes of this godforsaken piece of garbage, his buddies from the force are there to see him wake up. And, you know, they decide they're going to do this big dance number routine for him while he's there. But as he looks up, he realizes they've put a particular marital aid, we shall say, between his legs of a certain color. And, Mooney freaks out about this. And this leads, oh my God, to a scene of him wandering down the hallway with this thing in his hand, putting it down and demanding of the doctor, while clearly referring to his heart, while the nurse thinks he's talking about the marital aid in this instance, you put it in me, you can take it out. Because, yes, he is such a bigot in this point that despite the fact that this has clearly saved his life, he is asking that the doctor take out the heart, because that's just how much of a racist he is. So, again, this is our protagonist, folks. A absolutely uncompromising bigot. Like, it would be one thing if he were, you know, racist, but in the sense of he legitimately is oblivious to things, where it's like he legitimately does not understand that the things he's doing is racist and needs to learn that. He is an out and out hateful bigot, though. Okay, it's not like he isn't aware that he is a hateful bigot in this instance. He is actively choosing to do this. That is, I mean,
well, it's hard to play a laugh line out of, I would rather be dead than have a black man's heart keeping me alive.
Yeah.
I think Dave, like, while you are 100% not wrong, I think, like, this film is so misguided that Parriott was going for, like, the setup of this is for the gag to be about the marital aid, and the focus solely on that to make that quote unquote funny.
Yeah. I mean, you gotta admit, it's pretty big.
Yes. About, you know, you put it in me, you can take it out, right? Like, I think he's so focused on that being quote unquote funny that he completely disregards what this actually means when it's presented viewers on screen, like we're talking about now, right? Like, it's so careless that, like, I don't think it has any idea what it actually means. And the other thing is, surely there's got to be some sort of, you know, something in place whereby you don't know who the donor is.
Yeah. Yeah. Right? And like, everybody knows.
Surely there's, like, because, like, we've seen, I don't know if you guys seen Body Parts, the Jeff Fahey, I think it's Eric Red directed horror film.
I have not seen it yet.
Just meant like in nature.
Which is excellent. I think I would highly recommend it. Excellent B film from the early 90s. But like the idea is that Jeff Fahey, he gets an arm transplant and he spends half of the movie trying to figure out where it came from because he's got weird dreams and he's acting differently, blah, blah, blah. Turns out it's haunted. That kind of thing.
A haunted arm?
A haunted arm, yes.
Wow. That's also part of the plot of Metal Gear Solid 2, Guns of the Patriots. No, wait, that's number 4. Carrying on, though, yeah, it's weird because the whole premise of, like, the hospital wake-up scene is that Mooney is the last one to know.
Yeah.
And it's like, even if you were the first one to know, why would your squad mates know that?
Yeah.
You know? Did the doctors walk out and they're like, boy, guess what we just did, everybody?
And it's the doctor like, okay, so, I don't know, you're his boss. We could tell you, right? Like, no.
Now, he needs to be on light duties because we put this specific man's heart inside him.
See, but the thing is, even, let's just even put the heart side of it away for a second. Because even if you take that out, it doesn't change that the central quote-unquote joke of the scene, the visual gag of it, is built on a completely racist stereotype anyway.
Oh, yes.
So, I mean, like,
totally.
Like, Perry, what the hell are you thinking with this?
Again,
well, it's the problem of approaching questions of race. One. Yeah, it's approaching questions of race from an exclusively white perspective. And that's why, James, as you said, the focus is much more on, look at how hilariously large this thing is. Look at these hilarious double entendres, without ever actually considering, like, how would this same scene play to a more conscientious audience? And specifically, how would this scene play for a black audience? Because at no point in this film did I ever get the sense that it was intended for anything other than a largely white audience.
Oh, unmistakably.
And the problem is, when the film is written and presented that way, and it tries to talk about race, that's a clear problem.
Well, absolutely. Now, the film then jumps ahead 10 months after Mooney's recovery, where he's basically just been put on desk duty. His partner's actually been promoted here. And again, another detail I like, Captain Wendt, basically, when Mooney returns, is like, I don't want you here. I was forced to take you back, but I don't have to like you, and I don't have to want you. Which, again, yes, Captain Wendt, you have a logical thing. You are the 100% right character in this film when it comes to this man here. But yeah, Mooney gets put on light duty. We get the scenes of him being sort of clearly frustrated with this fact, and then he takes out his lunch, which is all health food in this instance, which frustrates him completely. So he decides, to hell with it, he's gonna go fall into old habits, he's gonna go get that greasy cheeseburger down at his favorite, I guess what would you call it, like, side restaurant, outdoor restaurant, whatever. And just as he goes to take a bite, James, what happens?
Oh, God. Denzel Washington appears and says, you're not going to put that in your body or something like that?
Yeah, it's basically him just chewing him. It's like, how are you going to do it? I mean, you know, the doctors have already explained, you know, you got to, you know, stay healthy in this. Which Mooney understandably starts wondering, what the hell is going on? Why am I seeing this? How am I wrecked this? And this leads to some embarrassingly, like, okay, let's be clear. Bob Hoskins mastered how to act with nothing around him for Who Framed Roger Rabbit. Okay. He set the bar, folks. And then you get this scene where the unseen.
Yeah. Well, he set the bar because he wasn't trying to be funny.
Yeah.
Like, he works in Who Framed Roger Rabbit because he's the straight man. Here, he has to be a lot more participatory. And you see the clear limits.
Yeah, because he...
Also interesting, he's playing almost the exact same character as Eddie Valiant, except
replace the word tunes.
And like with... a terrible human being.
Yeah. And that's just it. And yeah, as we see Denzel's Napoleon basically giving him a hard time, and we see, yes, you know, Mooney, you know, do as nobody can see Ghost Denzel there as he's wandering around looking like he's doing a weird dance in the air with his hamburger before falling down and walking away and trying to ignore the situation.
Boy.
Yeah, like basically the important thing for plot purposes is that Napoleon points out that, look, he was basically just going to try and stay quiet and not get involved yet, but he needs to, he wants to protect, you know, his heart and make sure Mooney doesn't die, because he needs him to solve his murder in this instance. Because it turns...
Now, I do like some of the edits in this scene, though, because every time Mooney gets away, suddenly the camera pans over, and then we see Stone walking from a different point.
Yeah.
Like, it's not terribly intricate, but it is edited fairly well. And I mean, it's also Denzel Washington giving the performance where, you know, it's sort of that, it's that blend of incredibly casual while giving significant information and sort of that almost ad-lib feel where he's talking about, yeah, I don't really understand it either. Like, you know, I walk away from you and the next thing I know I'm in a different place. That doesn't matter right now. The important thing is, I was murdered. You have to find out who murdered me.
Yeah, and Mooney basically just doesn't... He keeps trying to ignore him and ignore him and ignore him. I believe there is at least a scene set at the office first where he's clearly yelling at him before he heads home. Mm-hmm. And then finally starts talking with Stone in this instance about this and agreeing that it's okay. We're going to look into this here about this. And partly because, as he knows, it involves Crystal. In this instance, who he hasn't seen in any of these 10 months. That's going to be important, folks, as much as it shocked me at the time, because I'd forgotten that plot point, but we'll get there. So the point is that Mooney effectively agrees to start looking into Stone's death. And the first place they're going to start is by going to Stone's home there, where he arrives just in time to find out that, yeah, there is basically, they're selling everything off. Stone's mother.
Oh, yeah, it's the estate sale.
Yeah.
Sale.
Yeah, and it turns out that, yes, here's where we start learning a little bit more about Napoleon Stone. And, oh man, this is just such a weird scene. Because as they're wandering through, Mooney wanders into the bedroom and sees that, yeah, there are photos of Stone there with Crystal and all this. And he's sort of impressed by how much money Stone has made this, but he can't resist keep noting and trying to claim that it's all for being crooked and doing illegal things, which Stone does not put up with.
Which, as somebody who has gone on record of saying that I do believe in the right to counsel, I think another big sort of misstep in this film is that through these scenes, and especially the scene with Stone's mother, who sort of wags the finger at him for never settling down, you know, and condemning, as she says, so much in and out went on in this house, not a single grandchild to show for it. the problem is that we already know that Mooney is a pretty wretched human being. And the problem is that Stone ends up kind of being equivocated to the point where it's at least set up as these men have something they can learn from each other. But on the one hand, you have a borderline sociopath, racist cop, and on the other, you have a guy who provided legal defense to drug users and didn't have grandkids. They're basically the same.
Yes.
Yeah, it's so, like, very stuck in the 90s and very backwards in its approach, but...
I mean, it's near the same tier as Mark Ruffalo saying, "When I get angry, I turn into a monster. No one can love me." And Scarlett Johansson saying, "I know how you feel. I can't have babies."
Yeah. But without getting side-tangented on the Age of Ultron for a moment, the big point is that after the quote-unquote touching moment where Mooney reveals that, yes, he's the one who received Stone's...
Especially touching, because he pulls his shirt open.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Stone's mother caresses the scar. And it's like, you can't feel through Bob Hoskins' ribcage, you know?
Yeah.
It's just, it's very much a movie moment, but you take a step back and be like, what?
Well,
because it's fine up until that, where it's like, you know, they say that they gave my son's heart to a cop. And yeah, I know. And I guess the cop's name is Mooney. Yep, that's my name. And then they lock eyes, and then he unbuttons his shirt. It's like, why would you think that's something she wants, man?
Well, yeah. I will give Janet Dubois this. She is delivering a heartfelt performance in a film that does not deserve it at all. Like, she is trying her heart out to make this work. And I appreciate the effort, but you can't save the script. Yeah.
It's a good scene, and, like, both actors do it well. It's just, it doesn't, like every other scene in this movie, it's just not compatible with the scenes around it.
Mm-hmm. Well, absolutely. Which brings us to, okay, Mooney gets the photo of Crystal and Napoleon and heads out, and it starts, I'm trying to remember the exact order at this point, because I think it's at this point where Napoleon starts providing information about what went on that night, specifically there, where it turns out that, yes, Crystal was working for some individual. They were swept away. He doesn't necessarily know about the senator side of things, but that they were contacting him for help because of how serious the situation was. And that she was basically working for somebody who will turn out to be Graham. Now, Graham is played by Jeffrey Meek, and I mean, Jeffrey Meek, basically he's playing every late 80s, early 90s gangster villain who's, you know, supposedly upper class. He's got a beach home and that, but apparently he's also in...
He doesn't have to raise his voice. He gets what he wants. You know, it's basically, have you ever seen an episode of Miami Vice? That's who we're dealing with. You know,
yeah,
it's that whole suave 90s action movie villain.
Yeah, except this film wishes it had the quality of Miami Vice going for it. But yeah, I mean, ultimately, it turns out that Napoleon's big point is like, okay, look, if you're going to be going in and dealing with Graham in this, you're dealing with high rollers. You cannot be the way you currently are. So you're going to go to this bowling alley that my brother runs, and you're going to go in behind the all the lanes there, and you're going to basically grab this particular stash I have there, which is supposed to be of $200,000 which will be able to get you, you know, a decent suit and, you know, really make you look good. Which leads to a baffling scene where, okay, he comes in. And Mooney basically, you know, everybody's sort of confronting him where it's like, who are you? What are you doing here? We think you're in the wrong place. And Mooney basically explains, you know, I work for the police. You know, I'm looking into something. I just want to see in the back doors. He basically bluffs his way in claiming this is official business. And I should note here that because of his antics at the police station with talking to Denzel, Captain Went now has his former his buddies trailing him to keep an eye on what's going on. So there,
the plot of this movie is Harry,
played by Ray detailed. Baker.
Yeah.
Yeah, and like the whole plot with Crystal and the senator and how Graham even fits in, I honestly just stopped paying attention because I'm like, this is more information than I need to take in at this stage of the movie, given what this movie is.
Yeah, absolutely. But the important thing is that, yes, Mooney does recover the money, but when he goes to leave, it turns out, you know, they start confronting him about what he's got there. And the brother notes, it's like, there's $150,000 you've just taken from the back, to which, Denzel's, Napoleon starts pointing, it's like, wait, $150,000, are you stealing from me? And realizing, getting mad at his brother, for having done this, Which ultimately leads, even once Mooney seems to have de-escalated the situation miraculously to be able to get out here, Denzel takes Mooney's hand and then just shoves it into one of the bouncers, basically, of this place. And then they have to get chased out under threat here because, again, Napoleon's mad at his brother, and this seemed rational because you want Mooney to get the crap beat out of him before he solves your murder? Sure, why not? To which, yes, I guess we have the supposed laugh moment of the cops who are tailing Mooney, wondering, it's like, I wonder what all that was about. Just god-awful. But this does lead to probably what, yes, you refer to, Andrew, as the pretty woman sequence of the movie. And
oh, yes.
Which, yeah, how would you like to walk us through this one?
It's exactly like the scene in Pretty Woman.
Well, exactly, because it's the whole thing is that, as Stone points out, the problem with Mooney isn't that he has a heart that is black and full of hatred. It's the fact that he has poor fashion sense and low class. So they go to Beverly Hills, and we get the montage of him being fitted for suits and that. And him getting his hair washed, which he treats like it's this magic phenomenon. Yeah. But, you know, he gets as much of a makeover as Bob Hoskins in 1990 possibly can. And it
they
all
give
gets
him like a hairpiece, too.
Yeah. And we also get the, you know, the tailors who do not have lines but are clearly coded as gay giving him looks. And it all just culminates with, like, that. The big reveal. The walkout scene of Bob Hoskins actually looking pretty sharp, and while everybody fawns over, wow, he's a brand new man. And it's like, well, yeah, other than the fact that he's racist and currently on suspension. But if you look beyond that, I guess he is a brand new man.
And don't forget the punchline, here's the bill.
Like, it's...
Oh, yeah.
Did you guys catch that other little 80s gem of a comedic moment when he's having his inseam measured by another man and he makes like a look like, oh, God. Ah!
Hey, buddy, can you hurry it up?
Yeah.
That's when he turns and says, check, please.
Yeah, like, just, it's, yeah. But somehow this is still the least offensive scene of the movie thus far. So, kudos.
And I would also like to point out again, predates Pretty Woman by a couple months.
Fair point. So.
Yeah. So this film is a glimpse into the future. We've got Drive. We've got Pretty Woman. We've got Ghost Dad. We've got several great movies that can directly be traced back to this one. So it's like how Gregor Mendel wasn't really respected in his time, but now we understand that he is sort of the pioneer of what would become genetics. Foucault once said that you can be true and yet not within the true, and as we see in the film that follows, okay. So next, now that we have the makeover, surely Crystal will not recognize Bob Hoskins. He ends up using information from Napoleon to pay a call to our man Graham, name checks the right people, and he has to be set up with one of the girls.
Yeah, and this leads to, yes, what will be his, ultimately his quote-unquote date with Crystal in this instance. Now, the big thing here is that there's a couple of key things. First of all, Napoleon points out to Mooney that the problem here is that you never actually listen to Crystal, okay? You don't listen to her. You never do the things she wants. She wanted to become an artist or a photographer and go to art school. You never were supportive about that. You didn't put any time. You didn't put any money. And lists off...
Okay, but here's the thing that I hated about this scene.
Yeah.
Because as they're talking about it, like, Mooney's defense is like, well, why am I going to support her having, like, a pipe dream that's not going to go anywhere? Do you remember what Stone says in response?
No.
He's saying, you see a kid, like, words to the effect of, if you see a kid, like, on a rainy day, sitting in the mud and playing around, just having fun, you don't walk up to them and tell them what they're doing wrong. You just let them be. And I'm like, so, the best way to show love to Crystal is to basically tacitly say, well, yeah, you're an absolute amateur and you have no idea what you're doing.
Well, like, I thought you were going to say treat her like a child.
Yeah, the infantilization
is the most, yeah, it's like the most dismissive way to tell somebody you need to be more supportive.
Well, and the thing is that basically when Mooney and Crystal finally do meet at this high-end exclusive restaurant there, it ends up being, you know, this is actually a fairly decent scene where
it's cute.
Yeah, I mean
I don't know about that, you guys. Chloe Webb and Bob Hoskins, they work well together. I was kind of expecting there to be that moment where it's like, hey, would you like to try some of this? What is this? Escargot. It's pretty good.
Well, yeah. And
no, but we do get an escargot joke.
Wait, we do?
Yeah. Doesn't the... When he's going through the, like, the menu options, like, the specials, isn't he mentioned escargot and they make a gag about that? Or am I just...
It's...
No, it's because the waiter has that weird inflection where it's like, a grill de salmon, or whatever.
Yeah, it could, escargot could be in there, but honestly, I don't remember, and I mean,
the scene culminates with them bonding over the fact that they're publicly humiliating a waiter, and then they decide to go play pool.
Yes.
Yeah, and the important thing is that Mooney does promise, and again, one of the details like this is when Napoleon's getting frustrated about why Mooney hasn't grilled her about his murder or what went down that night. Again, one of the few moments that kind of works in this movie is when Napoleon puts it, it's like, do you forget that you're doing this on my dime? That I'm the one who paid for your new clothes. I'm the one who paid for this restaurant. I'm doing this here. There.
And well, also implicit within that, he's also paying Crystal for her services. And so it's hard to forget that underneath the meat cute, this is him soliciting her as a sex worker, too.
And yes. Well, to extract information.
Yeah. So, I mean, again, it's like, well, there are nice elements, but when you take a step back, it's like, no, you're also paying her right now. And you're also kind of taking advantage of the fact that you know that this woman, since you two have split up, has been forced into a life of being a sex worker. It's odd, and that really does kind of cut down some of the sweetness, because there are nice exchanges between Webb and Hoskins here, but it's hard to feel like this is romantic.
Well, and it doesn't help that the scene ends with, yes, implied coitus between them, which finally prompts afterwards Stone to point out, it's like, look, I've waited long enough. Are you going to ask her? And Mooney, in one of the few moments where he's right, it's like, I really shouldn't pressure her. Like, this is not the right moment. But finally caves in and does it. And after, you know, first of all, it turns out that some of the advice that Stone gave him, or the information about Crystal that he didn't know, is phony in this instance. Mm-hmm. Her favorite film being Pinocchio. No, it's not. And then all of a sudden, turning out, you know, once she hears that, she takes off running in great frustration, to which, yeah, Mooney chases after her. It's a really awkward scene. I see what you're going for, movie, but it doesn't quite click in this instance.
Well, I mean, in Mona Lisa, we saw a film where Bob Hoskins played a brutal man who has to navigate questions of romance, the sex trade, and race. And for some reason, that worked incredibly well. And I think it worked incredibly well because they didn't try to make it a comedy.
Yeah. Yeah. Boil it down. Let's start with that basic thing.
Which is even weirder because Mona Lisa has many funnier lines of dialogue and funnier moments than this one does.
Well, absolutely. But that one knows when to pick and choose when to do it and which characters to do it with. Are you going to have a scene with, oh God, why am I blanking on his name? Played Hoskins.
Robbie Coltrane.
Yeah, Robbie Coltrane. Yeah, in there. It's like, yeah, Robbie Coltrane's there. Yeah, you give Robbie Coltrane the laugh lines because he's the character who can get them and give them and banter well with Hoskins. But yeah, it's just here, it's just a giant mess. And it's at this point that, you know, with this there, they're trying to hunt down, it basically becomes a we need to track down Crystal as Hoskins continues to get in trouble with the police. I mean, he gets called in effectively for all of his elaborate spending and other problems here in this question by Captain Wendt, to whom he insists.
Well, we also get that great drop of, you can't drive a new Mercedes on a cop's salary.
Yeah, exactly. And I do love that Wendt's like, look, this is my golf day. I'm not supposed to be here today, and here I am dealing with you in this instance. And again, Captain Wendt, I love him so much in this film, because it's just like, he's the, like, I mean, we're so often asked to treat the captains as if they're these hard-nosed stick-in-the-muds in movies who are just, you know, getting in the way of our protagonist doing the right thing. No, Wendt's right 100% of the time in this movie about basically everything. So, I mean, I salute you, movie, even if I don't think for one second the filmmakers actually intended us to read the scenes this way. But yeah, I mean, basically because of this, he's put on suspension again. But finally, he, you know, sets out to hunt down Crystal, and this leads to the beach scene. And oh boy.
Oh my god. So, this is a singularity that the film cannot... What has come before simply cannot cross through this barrier. Because, I mean, it's a kind of an okay setup where, you know, Mooney kind of redeems himself by figuring out, based off, like, the markings on the bottoms of Crystal's feet, that it's beach tar, which means that it could only have been in one of certain regions in the area, is able to track her down. Sure enough, he finds her. They have a confrontation at beachside, again, similar to Mona Lisa, except where that was him understanding finally that he had been used and played, and his feelings of love were very much used against him by others, and lashing out with a frustrated emotion. Here, we see him basically cajole Crystal into telling him what's going on. She refuses and says she's in danger. He keeps insisting he wants to help. She says, no, you can't. And then we get the capper, which is her, like, basically producing almost from out of frame her child. Yes. And not just any child, a child with colored skin. And then we get everybody's world comes crashing down because Stone realizes that he is a father and now he's dead. And Mooney seems to be absolutely shocked that Crystal was pregnant with Stone's child. And then we get a moment where Washington is trying his best to convey, like, the facade crumbling, but it does not work with the script that he's given, because he walks over and, like, keeps being like, Mooney, that's my son, you know? Hold him, tell me what it feels like. And then Mooney walks away, and then we get the increasingly more severe, tell me what my son feels like! Tell me what my son feels like! And it's like, that's such an odd thing to be yelling at Bob Hoskins as he walks away down a beach wearing a three-piece suit. Like, it just doesn't hit the way that it's intended to hit.
Well, it doesn't. Now, the follow-up to the scene where Mooney's driving away and then he finally pulls over at the side of the road, and him and, you know, Napoleon finally come to a head. And this is... Look, if this had been a drama through and through, this would probably be the moment that you're like one of the standout moments of the film. Because it's wedged into this weird, weird-ass comedy, supposedly.
And this weird-ass sequence of events at this point in this comedy. Because, like, this is not a laugh line. Like, this is heavy orchestral music. This is leaning into melodrama at this point.
Yeah.
And it continues on as the two men have a shouting match, also at beachside. But, like, it begins with Mooney more or less going on, you know, everybody's least favorite uncle's stock rant about how, about presumably how black people just try to get close to you so they can hoodwink you or something. And it's like, but where is that coming from, Mooney? Like, are you referencing something specific in your life? Like, that seems like a weirdly specific thing to be dropping as, and that's the reason why I've never trusted non-white people.
Well, and more, the thing is the way Hoskins is delivering the scene, and Hoskins is working overtime to try and make this work. Like, he plays it like that this is Mooney at his most vulnerable, where, and again, it's all in the performance, nothing to do with the script at this point. You get the sense that Mooney, like, he is just somebody who is so anxiety-ridden and just fearful of the world and fearful of change there. But he comes off like, you literally see how pathetic he is in this moment and how pathetic his fears are. And again, Denzel, giving this scene his all, is straight up challenging him right back to his face about all of this, and, you know, basically challenging him to use the word that he knows Mooney is wanting to use here. And it is, again, a few simple changes to, or, well, not a few simple changes, a completely different film here. This could be a standout scene, and instead it's just like the, we have completely lost it at this point. Like, this film has stopped, basically given up on the pretense that we're in a comedy at all at this point, for no discernible reason, so that we can lead up to Mooney's second heart attack, because it seems because of all this, he's rejecting his heart. And then we come back with, you know, Napoleon sitting on the bed with Mooney, explaining to him, it's like, look, we got to move past this. We got to move on from this here. You know, let's not push this again here, as Mooney's laying in the hospital recovering here. And it's just like oh my God, like, just the whiplash and tonal whiplash to be, as we slowly get or quickly get our way back into zany comedy mode again, is just...
Well, no, the whiplash continues, because then we go into action movie climax.
Yes.
Yes.
Because, yeah, like, the Mooney and Stone reconcile in the hospital, and, you know, shot from overhead in the bird's eye, which is kind of okay. Mooney ends up, what is it? He hears the right phrase that makes him go through and develops all of Crystal's photographs. And then he finds the one of her and the senator, and despite being a suspended cop, he can order them to do a second autopsy on a deceased U.S. senator who, let's also remember, died from at the beginning of the film, so clearly it's just bones by now. And they are able to not only do it right away, but find out that the body had traces of cocaine in its system. Yeah. And, that's the secret that Graham is trying to keep. That's why he killed Stone. So, you know, on the off chance that Crystal and her friend told him about it, and then Graham shows up and does the icy cool menacing thing, ends up kidnapping Crystal, the child, and Crystal's friend, and then basically drugs them with, what does he say, Mexican black tar or whatever, and calls Mooney to basically make the deal, come with the film and come alone or you'll never see the girl again.
Yeah, and this leads to basically Mooney calling on his friends, who decide, to hell with it, we're gonna back him up, as Mooney is still racing with a pump action shotgun here to this, not sort of beach house, but not the beach house from earlier, a totally separate beach house.
At this point, the movie becomes To Live and Die in L.A.
Yeah. But basically, yeah, Mooney shows up, and first of all, you know, in the petty detail of using his keys to scratch up Graham's car and smash in the lights here, which is like, yeah, that's, you know, at least if I die, I'm going out by making you have to pay an automotive bill.
Well, I made a lot of noise outside, now to catch them by surprise.
And in one of the few details I do like, we have basically Napoleon pretty much going in into the rooms earlier and helping Mooney to navigate and avoid getting shot at. But eventually, yeah, they arrive in the room, and everything quickly turns into a massive gun battle, while Cheryl with Or, Crystal with her son is in the corner, doped up against her will, trying to understand things. Mooney just keeps shooting up everybody, trying to lead her down while Stone's providing advice where they are. They're trying to get them down, but this ultimately leads as they're getting her off the roof. At this point, sure enough, Graham shows up, ready to shoot Mooney and kill him, and God bless this 90s detail for how the scene ends. James, what so happens to be the tip-off that gives Mooney, even though he's shot and bleeding, the edge to survive the situation?
The tip-off is that Graham's cellular telephone rings right at the moment when he's about to shoot Mooney, and Mooney realizes Graham's behind him, and this... This is one of the unintentional times when I laughed, I think. So, like, the cell phone going off made me laugh, because, like, that's how this plays out. So, okay. And then Mooney fires the shotgun, kills Graham, and the recoil sends Mooney flying out the window to roll down, like, roll down part of the roof and land face first in the sand.
Yep. It does. And by the way, when we say, you know, a cellular phone, again, this is a 90s cellular phone that's on his...
Like Zach Saved Morris by the Bell, style.
Zach Morris, like stapled, like in a holster on his side.
It is. It weighs 14 pounds and has an impressive battery life of one half of 10 minutes.
It was really important that Graham had that on him for, you know, the I'm probably going to have to kill a man moment here. But
this way I can call people immediately after and tell them I did it.
Fair enough. But, okay, the police show up, they start moving everyone, and then we fade to black, and then we come back for...
Well, no, because this is kind of a clever edit.
Yeah.
Because we have Mooney, like, bleeding out in the sand. We have distraught Crystal, like, you know, crying over him. And then we sort of fade and then fade in on a church.
It dissolves, yeah, to the church.
And we think it's going to be a funeral. But then as we pan out, nope, everybody lived. It's a wedding.
And here's the thing.
Just...
This is... I have to...
The greatest scene of any movie we have watched.
Absolutely.
This is probably the best ending. This is even better than Doorman staring at the camera with a knowing smile in That Thing You Do.
Yep.
This is better than...
Good Friday.
Yeah. Yep, this is better than Bob Hoskins looking in the distance as it sinks in, Long Good Friday. This is better than Yossarian running off into the ocean in a paddle boat. This is better than the woman just walking on by at the end of The Third Man. This is the greatest ending of any film, because like all great silent film, it proves that film is a visual medium and does not always need words to convey its power.
Okay.
That's true.
In this case, all we need is the song Have a Heart.
Exactly.
Yep, Have a Heart by Bonnie. Is it Bonnie Raitt who...
It's Bonnie Raitt, yeah. So, a song that I probably haven't heard in 30 years.
It is pitch perfect, because as it kicks in, yes, the church doors open and everybody's coming out. And I, when I say everybody, I mean, we've got Napoleon's brother and the bouncer from the bowling alley showing up.
Why are they there?
Well, I think they at least have kind of a reason. I'm a little bit more confused by why the one young officer and the sex worker he was supposed to have arrested at the opening of the movie is with him as the date at this point. Like, everybody's coming out, and then we realize it's the wedding of Crystal and Mooney there, and they're all waving, Have a Heart's playing, everything's going on, and then we just see, you know, everybody's lining up for the...
And we also get close-up shots of Bob Hoskins smiling, holding up the child.
Well,
and like that combined with Have a Heart, combined with the fact that Hoskins is genuinely trying to sell, like being overcome with emotion, And knowing that this film was written and directed by a white guy who meant so well, it's just, it's impossible
to handle.
But
the other thing is that the majority of this scene is also in slow motion.
Yeah!
Like
yeah.
the beginning, so we've come full circle.
And what makes it even better then is the kicker to all this, because we see, as the song is still playing, Mooney holding the child with Crystal by his side, everybody's lighting up for the photo, he's got his arm out like, he's holding somebody, but nobody can see. And then his good buddy, Officer...
And Harry points out, yeah. Why is he holding his arm up like that? I don't know. Maybe it's something to do with his heart condition.
We got the title of the movie in there! And you might think that that's like, okay, that's our closing one. But no, no. They save the best for last.
We see who the true love in this film is between.
Because yes. the photo's taken, and we suddenly cut to the still shot... A Bob Hoskins with his arm out with Crystal by his side and the child between him.
In
black and white.
In black and white.
And then yep. slowly fading into color is the ghost of Napoleon looking on so happy about everything that's happened in this moment. Oh. And it's like, there are...
Like, the way it's framed, it almost looks like him and Hoskins are looking at each other with absolute love in their eyes.
Totally.
And it's magnified by the fact that Denzel Washington is about 3.5 feet taller than Bob Hoskins.
And it's just, it raises so many questions in my mind. Is Napoleon basically now with Mooney until his dying days? Like, is literally there going to be a whole, like, does Crystal understand the situation? Does she know about any of this? I saw, this is a terrible movie. I want to see the sequel, though, that tries to explore all the weird that is, oh, sorry, I shouldn't have said that, but all the weird stuff that has happened here, that has now been set up, because it is... Like, oh my god, this film. It is so, like, every terrible decision that was made throughout this movie culminates in this scene. Like,
and becomes incredibly worth it. It is just, like, as I was saying before, like, the problem is when majority white productions about race try and tackle the idea of race, there's that tendency to reduce and oversimplify. And the problem is that for all the problematics in this film, it's all glossed over with a big everything's okay ending. We all learn to love each other. But as Dave points out, this is also an ending that, like, asks about a dozen implicit questions that are not solved as well. And again, it's like, if we've learned anything through history, even through our lifetimes, it's that there is no easy answer to questions of race, to questions mm-hmm. of social harmony or unification. And as well-meaning as a text like this may be, and even though it goes about it in very wrong-headed ways, there is something just deeply... There's something that just feels so off about, you know, sort of dusting the hands at the end and being like, well, they learned to work together and save that woman, so I guess we all can do the same. See, everybody can get along. And it's like, everybody got along in this case through supernatural intervention, through a hackneyed, like, quasi-political thriller plot, and from a well-timed recoil kick at an opportune moment. Most people don't have that, you know? Most people have to live in reality. And, like, it's just... Again, it's... For a film that tries to go real as often as it does, it begins and ends in the realm of fantasy. And it's like, if you're trying to make a film that begins and ends as a living cartoon, then you can't really pretend to say anything of substance about real world issues.
And I think the other thing too, Andrew and Dave, is that I'm pretty sure Mooney doesn't learn any lessons by the end of this.
Nope.
Like, no. We don't see him. Like,
and again, it's this very transactional view of acceptance,
yeah.
where we don't like each other, but you helped me out, so now I can learn to put up with you.
Yeah.
And that's very different from the idea of like any kind of holistic change or recognizing why what you previously thought and the actions you previously took were wrong. Instead, here, the best we can get is that, well, Mooney stopped doing that. Three cheers for white people?
Again, funny enough, you know, this is the exact kind of ending the Simpsons openly mocked on the episode John Waters appeared on there. Well, Homer, if only every gay man could save your life, you know, imagine, like, oh my God, this is just, there are worse movies, let's be clear. Like, the thing is, we've watched worse on the show and ones that are more overall unpleasant. I am having a hard time finding one that was so, from the ground up, ill-conceived from the pitch meeting all the way to the finished product like this. Mm-hmm. And the fact that at no point in time does it seem that anybody stopped and said, maybe we're on the wrong path with all of this.
Well, yeah. See, I disagree with you there, Dave, because I think this premise can work. The basic plot elements. The problem with this film is that it never understands what genre and what tone of film it wants to be. And so it cycles through a couple different ones, and none of it works as a whole. So it ends up being incapable of doing anything comedic. It ends up being, because it gets way too serious later on, but it's way too zany to have a serious message. Like, it's a film that hamstrings itself by not picking one idea and going with it.
Oh, absolutely. And you're not wrong there. I mean, there probably is a version of this that could work. Maybe.
48 hours, but make one of them dead. Boom, there's your movie.
Can it be Nick Nolte?
Yes.
Oh, God.
I mean, like, yes, I think you can pretty much make a good movie out of any premise. I think this is the first movie I have ever seen where I'm not so sure about that. Like, I think the premise
it's
of this
better
is
than
so
Soul
fun.
Man.
Like, okay. If you tease
can we agree
it,
on that?
I don't know Soul Man.
Oh,
it's yeah.
Yes, the Robert Downey Jr. one.
Yeah.
No, it's C. Thomas Howell.
Is it C. Tom?
Yeah. I think,
and for those of you at home, it's about because of affirmative action, privileged white student can't get into Yale or whatever.
Yes, that's
so
right.
So he basically wears blackface.
Yes.
Okay, big hilarious comedy concept. You know, this isn't there, but there does seem to be like a latent reactionary politics running through the first half of this film too.
But I mean, like, if you tease out elements. Like, you know what? You take the actual, I don't know, like, quote-unquote mystery of this movie, and you strip it away from the fantasy elements and the comedy elements, that's a movie I'd watch. You take, you know, you can take the premise of, like, racist bigot, horrible human being has to reconcile with, you know, receiving a heart transplant from, you know, a black man. Okay, I'll watch that movie. I'll watch Buddy Ghost movie, but you squish all three of them together. It's just like so dumb. like for
hey
lack
guys,
of a better word.
What if we combine Guess Who's Coming to Dinner with K-9 and 21 Grams? That would be something everyone loves.
Yeah.
Oh, God. But that's just like, there's just, like, we sit there, and the thing is no matter how absurd our connections...
What if Irreversible, but Beverly Hills Cop? Yeah.
But this is just the thing. It's like, no matter how ridiculous the mashups we come up with, none of it's going to encapsulate just how freaking weird this movie is when you actually watch it. So.
Yeah, I think we all had ideas of what this film was going to be like before we sat down and viewed it. I don't think any of us had those expectations met. Rather, I think in every case, our expectations were completely shattered, simply because this film does not behave the way you expect a film to.
Yeah. I think, like, for what it's worth, I have seen, and Dave, you can attest to this, a lot of really bad movies.
Yeah.
I have sat through movies that I would have qualified afterwards as unwatchable. But there's this movie is somehow not hard to, I mean, like, it's hard to sit through in that, you know, a lot of the stuff is kind of cringeworthy, but it's not totally incompetent. It's not totally worthless for a couple of reasons. Like, one, because it's under 2 hours. It moves. It has, like, if you get past some of the other elements, like, it has a plot that you can follow that provides some sort of interest because there's an act, like, semblance of a mystery there. But I don't know. It's just it's a film that I find really hard. I would find really hard to give a star rating to.
Well, I mean,
like, I just, like, you know, like, it's,
I think the star rating is just a big question mark.
Yes, exactly. Like, it defies any sort of classification in terms of a rating of, like, good to bad.
Yeah.
I think it's also because a film like this, as it is, I think could only have been released in that small window of the early 1990s.
Yes.
Because by 1992, you know, you have the LA riots, and suddenly race, or at least comedy about race, takes on very different contours. You know, the idea that here, Bob Hoskins being in a car surrounded by black men that are trying to tip it over, that has a very different resonance 2 years later. You know, mm-hmm. The idea of, certainly as you go on through the 90s, the idea of sort of wealthy black Americans and the justice system, that becomes a very different thing. But also, like, you know, a couple years later, Denzel Washington is doing movies like Philadelphia. And, like, this is the only time in his career that this film could have come out. This was the only time in, like, American society where this film in this form comes out the way that it does. It's like, you know, for all we joked earlier about how this film inspired so many touches in later better movies, like, it really is a film that can only exist in such a small window of time.
Yeah.
And we no longer live in that time. And so it's so difficult, like, because we've argued about it before, films that don't hold up well, or, you know, even things like movies we love, like Purple Rain, that, you know, certainly have those moments that, you know, you never want to just sort of accept it as, oh, things were different back then. You know, homophobia, that was all the rage, and things like that. But, I mean, you do have to consider the fact that, you know, this film certainly would not be made now, not in the way that it is. And that doesn't make it okay, but, like, you sort of have to accept that because it's the only way to make what this film is sensible.
Well, you know, you're absolutely right. I mean, this is about as clear a snapshot into 90s pop culture as you're ever going to get there for all the wrong reasons. But, I mean, it is very much that. And it's just so baffling because I just have to imagine, like, what everybody, once the film was out, once, you know, everybody was reacting to it, like, what did everybody think? Like, I have to imagine that even a short way into filming, Denzel Washington had to realize, it's like, oh, God, I have made a terrible, terrible mistake doing this.
But to his credit, he does not phone in his performance.
Oh, no.
Nobody phones in their performances in this film. If anything, they're trying much harder than the film warrants.
Oh, absolutely. And that's just the thing where it's just like, I mean, and you're right, James. I mean, this is, there's a level of competency here. It's like, this film is just smart enough to do more damage than it would be if it was that much dumber. Like, I mean, and that's just the thing about it, where it's like, you have just enough ambition there and just enough awareness to get things wrong in a way that's completely different than it would be if you were just absolutely oblivious to what you were doing.
Yeah. I mean, like, you if you pair, like, some of the really poor choices this movie makes on, like a story level or, like, a scripting level and, like, a thematic level, you pair that with, you know, incompetently put together, then you can, like, dismiss it entirely, or you can, like, you can easily, you know, package that up in a certain way or unpack that in a certain way too. But like with it, it's just like, it just seems so weird. Like, and I don't know if we want to do hits and pits or move to that, but like you get a scene where like the action scene at the end is incredibly generic one, but also pretty exciting.
Yeah. No, you're
like for all its stupidity of having, you know, like a ghost, you know, tell Bob Hoskins, you know, who's around the corner or help him.
Mooney, check your six.
Yeah. Like to help him, you know, pass a baby out of a window to a woman that's, you know, full of heroin. Like
it's only a 10-foot drop, Mooney. You can do it.
Yeah, like, but she's so high, and like, and then Denzel's like looking over her, like he can also help to catch the baby, but he can't.
Yeah,
yeah. I also like how he jumps out the window first, and it's like, is any of that necessary?
Yeah, it's.
But anyway, but like it's competent enough and like exciting enough. It just has like I still cannot stress how weird the tone of this movie is, like above anything else.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And you're absolutely right. We should probably move into hits and pits because there's just like, I don't think that there's.
Did somebody say our patent pending bumper segment hits and pits where we celebrate and condemn the little things? I was wondering when I would get the opportunity to announce that. James, as our esteemed and beloved guest, I think you have now actually beaten out John Goodman and Peter Falk and Al Pacino as our most frequent name showing up on film strips for that honor. Why don't we start on a positive note? Let's begin with our hits. So for 1990s Heart Condition, what would you say gets your first hit?
My first hit is going to editor David Finfer, who, Dave, as you helpfully pointed out, also cut Santa Claus 2, Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey, The Fugitive, and Boxing Helena. For a couple of the reasons that you mentioned before, like, Andrew, like that first scene at the food shack, you know, where every cut, it looks like, you know, Denzel as a ghost is coming in, you know, from like a different angle kind of thing. Like that's kind of clever. And I was fairly surprised by the action scene at the end and how well that was cut together. I think mostly for, you know, Bob Hoskins' recoil out the window.
Yeah, a young Ringo Lamb actually saw this film and it inspired.
Oh, God. What about you, Andrew? What's your first hit for this one?
My first and forevermore the first hit of every film is the ending sequence of Heart Condition. Remind me about that next episode to revive this bit. That ending, like, it's the perfect encapsulation of what white Hollywood studio executives think is them doing their part to build a more perfect union. You know, it is so tonally superficial and pat and completely off the mark, completely at odds with everything we presented with. It's completely at odds with the reality we live in. But there is that sense, like this palpable sense of, you know, everybody sort of like looking at the footage on screen being like, well, gang, we did it. Mission accomplished. And like, it is just, again, as James said, like, the tone of this film is inscrutable, and it all gets capped off beautifully by that final sequence. It's not good, it's not bad, it's amazing. And anything that causes that strong of an affect response in me, that has to be a hit, because it's certainly not a pit. Dave, what about you?
Patrick Leonard's score to this film. Now, while I did criticize that one particular music cue and stinger Leonard's, the actual music through most of this film is actually really good. Now, it certainly helps that Leonard was basically, aside from writing the score to With Honors, the Joe Pesci holding a bunch of university students' papers hostage film, he also wrote a bunch of the early Madonna hits that we're all aware of.
Also scored James Foley's At Close Range, the Christopher Walken, Sean Penn film.
Oh, yes.
Which, and I'm going on a tangent for this because this is like one of my favorite film scores, mostly because it's built around the keyboard lines or riffs or what have you for the Madonna song Live to Tell.
Nice.
Which is my favorite Madonna song.
With good reason.
Nice.
Yeah.
They call him the Jim Steinman of the downtown crowd.
Sure they do.
I thought that's what you called me.
Well, I call a lot of people that.
At any rate, the important thing...
You're the Jim Steinman of guys who don't look like motorcycles.
There we go. But yeah, I mean, it's a really catchy and really fun score. Does not help the weird tonal shifts of this movie whatsoever.
No.
But it is absolutely, yeah. It is catchy and
memorable. We got some bop and hog jazz that's great for the initial scenes. And then it's like, by the way, I'm dead and I need you to find out who murdered me.
Okay then.
Thankfully they shift the score at that point, so it's like, by the way, Moody, this is my baby.
And on that note, to say, but
your friend is already dead. We have to get you out of this burning building.
Oh my god. We officially broke Andrew.
It's a wedding!
Oh god. And on that note, does anybody else have any actual other hits that they want to give in this instance?
I mean, I'll just shout out to Roger Mosley as Captain Wendt.
Yeah.
for that one scene. Like he plays that one scene at the beginning really well, when he's like just clearly like laughing in the face of Mooney. You know, when he said, like, you see, when he cites off all of these things that you did, and you use the N-word, and you're asking about your promotion?
Yeah.
Like, just, like, so, like, blown away by his incompetence. Like, it's, I really feel like we're, you know, he's the audience surrogate in this movie.
Fair.
Well, yeah. And much like the audience can't wait to go golfing instead as well.
Exactly.
You know, I would also just like to second how great the score is, namely the leitmotif of which does not occur at all in the course of the film. Yeah, I would say Ray Baker as Harry. I liked him. He seemed like who was the sidekick in My Blue Heaven, which weirdly enough came up on Twitter. It's Bill, not Bill Hader.
What's his name?
He was the dad in Rachel Getting Married.
Yeah.
He was also the voice of the computer in Interstellar.
Damn, why am I blanking on that?
Come on, Bill. Bill Irwin.
There we go.
He has a very Bill Irwin type vibe to him. But, you know, I liked how he performed it. Again, I like how most of the cast gives its performances. It's just like, again, punching well above average, given the script that they're working with. Dave, do you have any final hits?
Well, on that note, we have to give Denzel Washington and Bob Hoskins their due, because whatever else is wrong with this movie, that's basically everything. Those two are trying so hard to make this thing work, and you have to salute the effort and the commitment to the effort here, because
I think they have a decent amount of chemistry together as well.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and again, you know, on the behalf of Hoskins, the fact that you could take a character this inherently loathsome and at least make him tolerable for the running time is no small achievement here, in this case. And again, that has nothing to do with the direction, that has nothing to do with the script. That is entirely down to Hoskins working overtime to get that reaction. So, I mean, that would be the last hits I would give. But that then brings us to the pits, and sweet Jesus, what is there left to say? James, what jumps up to you?
Oh, man, like, everything? Like, I don't even know. Like, just like, the whole idea of this movie. Like, as you said, David, like, this movie is so misguided right down to its core.
Yeah.
That, like, everything else just sort of, like, goes off. And it's not even, like, you can pinpoint, like, a moment to say, like, oh, God, like, that was, like, that's, like, a real, like, cringeworthy moment. Or, like, I can't believe that they would go in this direction, because it's all so wildly out there.
Yeah.
And just so off. And, like, I blame all of that on the tone of this movie. It's just, like, I kind of want to watch it again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
To try and parse out this. It begins at the
point, like, of no return, and then proceeds for 2 hours.
Yeah. And I mean, like, and I know a couple other friends I think would have fun watching this movie with. So, who knows, right? Like, that's...
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, that's the thing. It's like, it is compellingly bad as a movie. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you have to be a very special kind of terrible to hit that level. And... Which yeah. is why, yeah, I think it's impossible not to give a pit to James D. Perriott, even though in a weird way he comes right back around to almost being a, not a genius, but whatever weird...
Maybe a savant.
Like, there's just, yeah, there's something here that, like, he is clearly getting everything wrong, and yet somehow... What we see before, it's like, it's never boring. It's never, you know, not mm-hmm. compelling in all the wrong ways. It's just, you know, a masterstroke of ineptness in a way that many filmmakers almost, I would imagine, wish they could fail as spectacularly as Perriott does here.
Yeah.
Like, this is like the idea, like, if you're gonna fail... Fail like this, folks. I mean, in a certain way. But like, oh my God, what if
I want to see, like, the pitch meetings for this. Like, I got an idea for a comedy.
Yeah,
racist cop gets haunted by the ghost of a black lawyer, and has to solve his murder. Oh, okay, go on. And at the end, the bad guy shoots up a couple women with heroin.
Okay. Like,
okay. There's also a baby and a wedding.
That's the reveal.
And I just got this idea on the way over here. I heard the new Bonnie Raitt single on the radio. Why don't we play the song in its entirety?
Yeah.
Oh yeah. And you guys know how the fat cats up in Washington, they always say one thing and do another. We can use it.
Exactly. Like,
a lot of people love cocaine these days.
And you just know that Bob Shea was the one who had to probably give the green light on this thing. And I'm just imagining, if it's like, remember, this is only 5 years out from Nightmare on Elm Street, or 6 years out from Nightmare on Elm Street. Yeah. And this is what New Line is. This is the studio that's going to go on to make, you know, the Lord of the Rings films in 10 years.
Yeah. Like... But they were also the studio that said, sure, they all grossed $1 billion. That doesn't mean there's any profit to give to anybody.
Fair.
Who knows? Yeah. Hollywood's a weird place.
Yeah.
I think I would also just like to give special mention to how... I want to give a pit, not to Chloe Webb, because I think she does what she can with very little, but I just, case in point of where this film is just so head-scratchingly wrong. Like, Chloe Webb, her performance as Nancy Spungen in Sid and Nancy is an incredibly raw, like, a chaotic and almost dangerous kind of performance. I don't know who would have seen that and said, let's have her be the mousy call girl who really wants to be good at photography. Like, it's one of those things where, like, she does her scenes fairly well, and, like, when she needs to be sweet, she is very sweet. But, like, this really is the sense where it's like watching Uma Thurman in Paycheck, where you're like, I know you're capable of doing so much more because I've seen it. You know, it really does feel like a missed opportunity, because you're getting a very capable actress to play a role that is basically insignificant.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. And, you know, it is a shame there. And again...
But, like, also think about Chloe Webb, where it's like, you know, she hasn't been in a tremendous amount of movies. Two of them are Sid and Nancy and heart condition.
Yeah. It's
that, like, that classic Hollywood move of finding, like, a talented actress, and, you know, after their breakout performance, like something like Sid and Nancy, and then trying to give them roles where they do nothing.
Yeah. And on that note, do either of you guys have any more pits before we zip up the body bag on heart condition?
I am out of pits.
I'm not, but we would be here all night if we went through every single one of them. So let's just move on.
Well, there's always the Christmas special. Yeah. We'll come back and reflect on lessons learned since the last time we watched Heart Condition. But from the last time, we segue to the next time. And Dave is going to tell us what movie we'll be looking at next episode and who we're going to follow to get there.
Well, Chloe Webb, we're not done with you here, but no, we're not heading to Sid and Nancy. Instead, we're jumping ahead 7 years to take a look at... Well, that weird curiosity that you might remember from the late 90s, if only because all the ads used the song Semi-Charm Kinda Life in the advertisements for it. Yep, exactly. We got...
Oh, wait, that's a different one.
Yeah, no, we are following Chloe Webb to Nick Cassavetes' She's So Lovely. A film made from a script by his father, the late John Cassavetes, starring a returning John Travolta, Sean Penn, who I think we... Oh, no, this won't be the first time because we covered him in Carlito's Way. Harry...
Yes, we did.
Yep, Robin Wright and Harry Dean Stanton and James Gandolfini as well. Oh, and Tito Laveria from True Stories here. Sadly, I get the sense that we're not going to see him performing the song Radiohead this time. But we shall see. So this is going to be at least an interesting episode. Maybe not heart condition interesting, but I don't think many things in life are heart condition levels of interesting.
Damning with faint praise indeed. But there's nothing faint about the praise that we have for our good friend James. It's always a treat to have him on. Isn't it, David?
Oh, damn right.
It's always a treat to be on here.
James, in the meantime, I know you probably continue to be very active. You're still doing your letterbox. What do you got to plug, and where can people get in touch with you and find out that, you know, Dave actually does have a companion in the sense that you guys have forgotten more about film than most people will ever learn.
Well, thank you. You can find me on Twitter at J_Rivnak, HRIVNAK. The H is silent. You can also find me on Letterboxd using the same name there.
All right. Dave, what about yourself? Let's say the estate of Bob Hoskins and the litigation team of James Parriott want to get in touch with you. Where can they find you?
You can find me at 24 Panels. I think you're just going to draw more attention to this movie if you take that road. So I'm not terribly worried that that's actually going to happen. What about you, Andrew? Where can people find you?
Yeah, you can find me sleeping under a trestle bridge with Denzel's former agent. You can also get in touch with me at FilmStripper. Best way to reach me, because parenting, it's a gas. You can email the show directly at filmstripspodcast@gmail.com. Tony M, yes, I did get your message. And favorite shellac album, probably 1000 Hertz. If you want to rate and review us, head on over to iTunes and leave us a review. Make like Ebert, except give us 5 stars instead of maxing out at 4. And that helps us move up the featured list. But more importantly, it's where you can leave some feedback and let us know what works for you and what doesn't. Because, lo, across these many bizarre and very rewarding episodes, all Dave, I, and guests have ever wanted to do is bring you a show you want to listen to.
Indeed. So, on that note, Andrew, are there any parting words you'd like to leave your audience, or the audience, with?
Why, yes, David, there are. Remember, everyone, adventure may scare you, but monotony will kill you.
Normally, I'd make a joke at this point, but there is nothing I can say that's actually weirder than the film we just discussed. So, bye.